Great to have you along on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're covering legal issues for the next hour and a half or so with our two guests, Mike Riley and Tom Colpine. Mike is a retired Madison attorney. His practice focused on obtaining fair compensation for people who suffer injuries due to others' negligence. And he is what they call an off-counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm. Mike, welcome back. Good to have you with
us. Thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
And Tom Colpine, an attorney who practices family law, paternity, estates, planning, and I guess a whole lot more. A partner in the Axley Law Firm, he recently served as Rock County Family Court Commissioner, doing that for nearly 8 years. Tom, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And just a reminder today, our discussion is intended as general information. You should not be relied on or construed as legal advice. I wanted to get that out just to begin the show. Family law deals with so many issues. Give us your questions about divorce or guardianship. We can take your questions, personal injury as well, as we move along today. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And Tom, just before we get going, I sort of mentioned you as a broad range of things. Where's all your experience lie, really?
Sure. Family law encompasses quite a few different types of legal issues. Like you mentioned, for nearly 8 years, I was the Rock County Family Court Commissioner, where I presided over divorces, post-divorce issues. So folks that have finalized their divorce, new issues have come up of dispute. You can separate them into custody, placement, child support, determinations of paternity, maintenance, property division. Anything you can possibly think of that a family might have conflict in is something I used to do as a family court commissioner. Now I'm in private practice. And really, the trend is shifting with many of our practitioners to try to get people to help resolve their conflicts before they make it to the court. So I'm focusing a lot on mediation, out-of-court settlement type negotiations, mediation, arbitration. Parent coordinators are a new thing for those high-conflict cases that tend to find themselves into court all of the time. There's some delay with the court system and getting your conflict scheduled to have a decision. So we're really pushing people into making solutions instead of hoping for long-term decisions with the court.
Makes a lot of sense to me. And Mike, I know you wanted to talk a bit about risk and risk issues today on the show, among other things.
Yeah, I thought this was triggered by a call I got from some very nice folks who had just bought some land from their mother. They had two families, two of the siblings were buying the land and they were splitting it. And they had concerns about what their liability might be if for activities on the land. And in the course of the discussion, we talked a lot about insurance, of course, and they had consulted with their insurance company, really with their agent, and they had talked to him about they had an umbrella. And the question was whether that would cover activities on the land. And frankly, I would have thought it would not. The agent had told them it would. And I said, that's great, but I'd get it in writing because, you know, you want to be certain that if you're relying on that, that you have that protection. But it just brought up a lot of issues about risk. For one thing, the company they'd been with for 30 years. And I think for so many of us, we go with an insurance company and we just stay there. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. In this particular case, they're with a national company that used to have a really good reputation, at least among attorneys, both plaintiff and defense, and really has pretty much squandered that. They're not held in high regard by anyone within the legal profession. And frankly, they're probably not a company I'd want to be insured with. And I suggested, as we've talked about before, look around, shop around. Every time you see an ad for an insurance company, they talk about how much money you can save. Well, that's because, you know, if you go to a different company, the reason you switch usually is money. You know, it's because you're getting a better deal. And that's important. But just as important is having a company you can rely on, because people think that life is full of more risk than it is. The fact is, most of us never have a serious motor vehicle accident. most of us, thank heaven, don't have a house burned down. Mm-hmm. But if any of those things happen, even though they're unlikely, you better have a company that's going to take care of you and protect you. And so that's really important. We talked a lot about land ownership. There's a statute called the Recreational Immunity Statute, which is really pretty broad. And it was initially lobbied for and sold as the Hunters and Berry Pickers, Deer Hunters and Berry Pickers Law. And it's a lot broader than that. So if you own recreational property and you simply permit people to go on the property, you have virtually no liability at all. I mean, you have very broad protection against liability. On the other hand, which I've always found ironic, if you invite people on your land, if you have a party, and I had a case just like that where people had a party, they had a hill, they had lights on their little sledding hill, and they had, unfortunately, those were on telephone poles, which they didn't shield, and somebody was injured badly. A social guest is an exception to the recreational immunity statute. So, you know, an actual host, suddenly you assume liability you wouldn't have otherwise had. But I just think, in general, risk is an interesting issue, because that's what insurance is all about, is risk spreading. You know, you pay a certain amount based on what you might have to lose, and, you know, you gauge your needs for insurance, again, on what you have to lose. If you're 22 years old and just out of college, you probably don't need a lot of liability insurance. If you're, you know, in your 40s, 50s, or for that matter, in your 30s these days, you know, if you're a tech wizard and you've got a lot to lose, then you better have a lot more insurance coverage. Anyway, those are just some thoughts on that.
There's things to bring up, or maybe that might spur some other questions. And speaking of questions, all our lines are filled. So Brad in Janesville. We'll go to Brad in Janesville first. Brad, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. This is about parking and zoning. Hopefully one of your guys is knowledgeable. There's a small village in Rock County, and in this village there's a small commercial street. There's no residences on it. So it's only business. And a couple of years ago, they instituted a very strict no parking regulation on that street, $500 fine, put up signs everywhere. I've gotten two tickets, and I've paid a lesser fine amount, but my friends and other commercial contractors get ticketed on this street all the time. And to make matters, you know, even look a little bit more shady, they're allowing one business owner on this street to just simply take photos of quote-unquote violations and then submit them to the court. The court issues tickets, and then they call in this business owner to testify that, yes, Your Honor, I saw him and he was parked there.
So you're wondering about challenging this issue of having this street blocked off. I'm taking it, Brad.
Since Tom's from
Rock County in the state.
Yeah. Well, you're in Rock County, Tom.
Sure. Hi, Brad from Janesville. I'm Tom from Janesville. I work in the Janesville office for Axley Attorneys. So really what I'm hearing is maybe two separate issues. Number one is, how do you challenge the municipal citation and whether you should be imposed a forfeiture for violation? And you have your court process to handle that, where you receive your court date. You can challenge the case and whether you should be imposed a forfeiture to a judge. And I'm sure either you or your friends have gone through that process, and perhaps you've even negotiated your lower forfeiture with the local city attorney, assistant city attorney. I think his name's Nels Chomey. And if that's the case, I think that's a great result if you can do that. Number two is really whether or not there's an ability to challenge how that street has the no parking sign, the specific forfeiture. I will not profess to have this be part of my expertise, but what I would say is, you mentioned that this is a village. I would make sure that your village board knows exactly what the community's complaints are with that, and ask them to address your complaints in that regard, and see if there's a way that you can somehow change the landscape of that parking ordinance itself. And I think if it's a village, you've got to start with the village. And if it's in the city limits, you start with the city. That's where I kind of see two different issues. Number one, with the municipal court side of things, if there's a witness who can come to court and testify that they have personally observed a violation of an ordinance, and that's the fundamental part of our legal process, is you have the right to confront in court witnesses who testify against you. You have the right to present any independent evidence. And if that person who owns that business says, look, there's an ordinance here that says you can't park here, people are commonly doing it, we want to address that on our end because we feel we're affected by it. So we're going to take pictures. We're going to share it with the local municipal law enforcement agency or the city attorney or village attorney. And we want those tickets issued. If they're following the ordinance, unfortunately, I think you got a difficult leg to stand on the municipal court side of things. So my advice would be that you got to get to that village board or the city, the local governing agency, and voice your complaints loudly there. Perhaps I'm saying something you've already tried, but that's the best I can offer you to right now.
Yeah,
that's great advice, Tom. And I think in general, you know, when people get tickets, some people just choose to pay, and that's obviously your choice. You can almost always negotiate tickets down. If it's a county, then you go, deal with the district attorney. If it's, a city, a municipality, it's either a city attorney or a village attorney. And it's something you should do because it's almost automatic that they will reduce the fine. Tom?
Yeah, something to add to that. That's a great point, Mike. I would encourage the people who are receiving these ordinances, if you take issue with the parking itself, first of all, you're not going to get the judge or perhaps the village or city attorney to change the ordinance because you've challenged it. But if enough people challenge it, you highlight a problem. A really quick example of that, many years ago, I was a municipal attorney for a village in outside of Beloit and Janesville. And this was back when it was illegal to get paid out to gamble on those gambling machines at the local restaurants and bars. And a local bar would consistently send over complaints for people writing checks that would bounce. We call them worthless checks. And if the worthless check amount was didn't reach a certain threshold as far as monetary value, the local agency, the police department, would issue tickets for worthless checks. And enough people started saying, wait a second, I'm getting prosecuted for worthless checks when I was writing checks to the bar for purposes of illegal gambling. And as the municipal attorney in that situation, I kept seeing, now our municipal court's getting bogged down by all of these challenges, and I've got to justify to the court why this person should pay a fine. So then I went to the village board, and I said, we've got a problem here. You need to go talk to this local business owner and say, you can't publicly violate the law and expect that we enforce the same law that affects you negatively, right? So the lesson here is don't hesitate to exercise your rights to challenge these ordinances because the winds of change can move in different directions, even though one individual case may not necessarily change that ordinance.
The other thing you might think about, and we won't beat it to death, but talking to the Janesville Gazette or the local paper, somebody there might be interested. Finally, dealing with these villages can really be a problem. We had a client years ago who had a piece of land that was landlocked. Well, you can't legally, you couldn't do it. And we went to the village board and I said, you have to give them access. No, we weren't going to do it. And ultimately we went to court. They had to pay our costs. They lost. I told them they wouldn't listen. And after the whole thing, I talked to the president of the board and I said, well, why would you do this? And he said, well, my nephew owned the other land that you're getting the access over. So I think Tom had suggested that already. But you wonder if the business owner who's taking photos, what his relationship
sure.
is. Anyway, enough.
Mike Riley and Tom Klopian, our guests today with the Axley Law Firm of Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. At 12:30 today, we'll take a visit to the historic Wade House. They have Wisconsin's largest collection of carriages and wagons, and we'll hear why you can't miss it. Right now, though, we're taking your questions, dealing a little with family law. We've dealing with a variety of things, actually, with our two guests from Axley Law Firm, Michael Riley and Tom Klopian. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Lalita in Madison, we'll go to you. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling because I established a trust about 20 years ago when my husband passed away. Uh-huh. And I'm in my 70s now. And I'd like to make some minor changes, like changing the executor and making some changes for my DCHPOA, things like that.
Sure.
Can I just do an amendment and have it notarized? Because I call the lawyers and they charge a lot, like $350 an hour, and they're just minor changes.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lalita.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's a difficult way to answer this. Without seeing what your trust says and how intricate and detailed it is, it's extremely difficult to adequately tell you whether you should simply write something up and have it notarized. I'm sure that you may feel like, well, this is how the lawyers get you. They want to charge you that high rate. But what you could think is an easy solution could create a massive problem if you're not exactly sure what your trust says and how you want to change it. Essentially, making minor changes like who you want to be the personal representative of your estate upon your passing, which I think you used the term executor, they're interchangeable terms, oftentimes used in Wisconsin as the term personal representative. If you want to make that change, it would seem rather simple for you to be able to do that, where you don't need to rewrite your entire trust. And similarly, if you're making changes to your healthcare power of attorney, where you want to rename some new agents, it wouldn't seem to be too difficult to be able to do that. However, depending on the kind of trust you have, the laws have changed significantly in the last 20 years in ways in which people have maximized the purpose of trusts. I would advise you to contact a lawyer or a law firm and ask if they conduct free consultations. This should be something rather simple for someone who works in this area on a regular basis, who wouldn't charge, to be able to review your document and give you that kind of urgent care diagnosis of here's what I think you might need. But I definitely wouldn't advise you to simply write something up and go to someone who notarizes your signature. The general public assumes that when you get something notarized, that it has some sort of important legal effect. And all a notary does is it personally swears that they have identified you as the person who signed the document. It doesn't make that document any better. It doesn't make it any more enforceable. It only acknowledges that we have made sure that Lalita is the person who signed that on that day.
There you go, Lalita. Thank you for calling. Paul and Toma, we'll go to you next. Hi, Paul.
Oh, thank you. This call is probably similar to Lalita's. I am going to be 67 this year. I really don't have family, kids. I'm not married. Brothers, older nephews, in good shape financially. If I leave stuff to them, they'll just go buy cars. And that's, my father used to sell insurance. That's what he said. People just buy cars when you die. I would like to find somebody, an executor of some sort, whether it be a law firm, a bank, that would perhaps I could set up a trust, all of my assets, which should total to about $1 million, that would then be distributed over perhaps 10 or 20 years through my Roth, through different charitable investments. The government puts out a book that lists all of the reputable charitable investments that you can put your money into and lists their overhead fees and things like that. So perhaps an executor who would just go through and every year pick 10, give money to those funds, the next year pick another 10. But somebody who would do that until the trust was either fully liquidated or into perpetuity, because, again, my Roth is before the change of those laws, and just keep it going. Is there somebody I can go to that can actually set up such of an account that would follow my directives but wouldn't have the ability to filter off too much into their own pocket? I understand their expenses, but otherwise it's just going to get squandered.
Yeah. Okay, Paul or Tom, I guess we'll go to you for
sure.
That one.
Sure. I think one of the biggest takeaways I have from your example is you don't want your brother and you don't want your nephews to have exclusive control over how that money is spent, because you would like to see it directed in other ways. And you want to do it through the form of a trust. You can certainly do that. I would strongly advise that you retain an attorney to draft the trust. And that trust can name a corporate trustee. Oftentimes, if you work with a highly experienced and sophisticated law firms and lawyers in your community, they do this all of the time. And they probably have a good list of banks with trust departments or investment firms with trust departments that could easily take over control and management. I couldn't tell you what they would charge for fees. I think that that would be something you'd want to look into. But I definitely think this is something you could easily do through the form of a trust, and you would be able to dictate how it is spent over time based upon the amount that you have. And most good, experienced estate planning lawyers that work in the area of drafting trusts, they have many different templates and examples because they've trusted them and they've worked over time to minimize risk of conflict in the future, but also to give you some examples of how you might want to allocate exactly where that goes over the course of time and how it's preserved for the future.
Yeah. Mike, how do you pick a good, now Paul's in Toma, how do you pick a good attorney for something like that?
Well, it's, you know, part of it always is personal contacts. If you know people who've used attorneys, you can talk to them, get recommendations. You know, there, Martindale Hubbell ranks attorneys and tells you there's an A, B, C, different things, and a V, which just means they're supposedly very reliable. Nothing is perfect. There's also, there's an annual ranking of attorneys that Milwaukee Magazine does called Super Lawyers. And they rank lawyers and give you the names of people who other lawyers think are very good in their field. And that's certainly something that's worth looking at, too. And I think, and Tom can weigh in on this, too, but I think one of the things that we've talked about in the past is go and meet with people. You know, meet with them, talk with them, find out how much they're going to charge you, find out, you know, are you comfortable with them? Because ultimately, when you go to a lawyer, and once you hire them, you're really relying on them. That's why you're there. It's not your field. It's their field. And you really need to have a comfort level because you don't want to be second-guessing yourself or worried about, did I choose the right person? Tom?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think one of the best things you have going for you is the freedom of choice. You know, I would use this analogy quite frequently when I was a family court commissioner and folks would decide to represent themselves and have quite a bit of family conflict and really walk into a courtroom, and understandably so, but have no idea how the law impacts their dispute. The beauty of estate planning is you have freedom of choice. If we want to fly somewhere, we have a couple of airlines, and the prices are usually astronomical, or you get the most affordable but least of experience. And many other aspects of where you hire the professional to do something, you're kind of limited in your choice. And I would argue that within our state and the legal system in general, the choice of law firms with estate planning services is vast and, ordinarily speaking, highly experienced in those areas. And the fee schedules may range, and they usually range based upon area. What you could get from a lawyer for the same level of service in Toma would probably be a different charge than right downtown in the Capitol Square or downtown in Milwaukee. So my advice to you would be to shop around in that circumstance. And like Mike said, meet people. Technology has changed quite a bit. So even if you want to use that bigger office with many attorneys and highly experienced attorneys who handle these types of things in major metropolitan areas, you can do so with technology these days with self-authenticating affidavits, virtual affidavits. So you might not even have to leave Toma if you don't want to. But I would advise you to shop around.
Paul, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Sue in Cable will go to you now. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Related question. What is the difference between a POA for finances and a successor trustee?
Power of attorney for finances versus a successor trustee, Tom?
Depends on the trust, but ordinarily speaking, they could be extremely similar. Power of attorney for finances is someone that you designate during your lifetime to stand in your legal shoes, as I usually explain it to people, that they have the same legal authority as you to conduct your business affairs, and they hold what's called a fiduciary duty to do so, which means that they can never make a decision that would ever benefit anyone but you, even if it's to their own personal detriment. So that's a power of attorney during your life. A power of attorney terminates upon your death. However, you could have a trustee overseeing and administering a trust during your lifetime that has very similar powers and duties as a power of attorney during your life. But then a successor trustee could also be someone who has the same authority over the trust to administer it according to the terms of the trust upon your death. Secondarily, successor simply means they weren't the first. So if you name a trustee in a trust and that person declines to serve as your trustee or is unavailable to serve or you need to name a second one, successor simply means you have nominated them to take over in the event that the first one is unable or unwilling to act.
Sue, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's move on, take another call. Gary in Milwaukee. Hi, Gary.
I have a question. My father recently passed, and he left me a home worth about $60,000. I would like to give this to my daughter. And I'm wondering if there's a limit on how much I can give her on an annual basis. Can I just, if we plan to sell the home, can I just sell the home and give her the 360, or do I have to break this into increments that will not, you know, have a tax consequence?
Thanks, Gary. First, I'm sorry to hear about your father's passing, and this is, your question comes up almost every day with estate planning attorneys. I want to be clear that I'll dabble in this. I don't use it as my expertise. I've spent most of my career in the area of family law, and I've oftentimes told people the very second that I don't feel comfortable diving into this, I refer you to an estate planning attorney who do this every day. And I equate it to I'm a survivor of brain surgery when I was younger, and I never wanted a foot doctor to do my brain surgery, okay?
Yeah.
So I certainly advise that you contact an estate planning attorney. But generally speaking, what you're bringing up is what could trigger the gift tax. And there's an annual allowance that you don't have to report to the federal government of how much you've given away each year to someone. But then there's a lifetime maximum allowance. So even if you don't give away, I believe it's around $18,000, right now, don't quote me on that. Estate planning attorneys who are listening are saying, geez, this guy, come on. but it's around $18,000. And if it's under that, you don't have to report that particular year. But in addition to that, there's a lifetime allowance of if you've gifted so much over the course of your life, that can impact things. So what I would advise you to do is contact hopefully, if your father drafted a will and that attorney or the law firm is still around, start there because they probably have notes and information about how they drafted your dad's will and created that estate plan. But make sure that you do that in a way where, I mean, there could be ways for you to disclaim receipt of the home within the estate process that then passes to your daughter with no tax consequence at all. But again, I'm the foot doctor talking about brain surgery right now. So I would advise you to talk with an estate planning attorney.
Certainly sounds like a good idea, Gary. Good luck. Thank you for calling. You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. George in Sturgeon Bay has a question that I think relates to something that off-air we were talking about earlier. So, George, it has to do with landlocked property. George, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just heard part of this because I just got in the car and turned on the radio. But we have two 10-acre plots that are landlocked. We're able to get an easement of, I think it's 30-some feet, but the county won't let us build under anything until we get an easement of, I don't even remember what it was. But we can't use it other than walk on it. So I'm wondering if there's a way of being able to get that taken care of.
So it sounds like you need to, instead of 30 feet, you need more than 30 feet.
Yes, I think it's something like 60 feet. Their reasoning is if we were to build on it, they have to get fire back there and school buses and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and again, I think this one falls in a very large crack between what Tom and I know and what the rest of the world knows. But what I can tell you is that there are laws which protect you from being landlocked. And I would think, because other than that one experience, this is not my field. But my guess is that you certainly should talk to a lawyer, talk to somebody who specializes in land use and see what they have to say. Because effectively, if they're saying you can't build on it, then you are landlocked. I mean, it's at least for all useful purposes, or at least yours, you're not grazing goats, which was the case in my case years ago. You're not, just having pets on the land. You're actually wanting to use it. So I think you need to talk to a land use attorney and see if you can get somebody. I mean, you probably have to go to whoever the zoning authority is, whether that's a village or a municipality or the county, and see what they will give you. And you might probably need to petition. If the law favors you, you might have to go to court. In my example, and it's not the sole example, I spent a lot of time dealing with smaller authorities. You don't have that problem so much with municipalities or the state or the county, but I suspect Tom's had the same experience. You can run into some significant degree of home cooking when you start dealing with smaller entities. That can be a problem. So who is it that's telling you that's telling you have to have 60 feet? The county?
Okay. Oneida County Zone.
Okay. And have you asked the county if they'll give you an easement?
We've mentioned it a few times. This all came, I actually dealt with a trust of my father's.
Uh-huh.
And so this land in our family for a long, long time, as well as the mother's that's on a road, so we don't have to worry about that part. So, as laws changed, all of a sudden this became under that whole situation.
Who gave you the easement for the 30 feet?
In the sense of...
Was that the county or was it, a village or a municipality?
It was the county, and I basically just went to a surveyor, and he wrote up the papers for it. We thought we'd be under this sort of pre-law change. If my dad had done something about it maybe 10 years ago before the fact, would have been...
The first thing I do is go back to the county and say, we need 60 feet. It's your rule. You're telling us we have to have 60 feet to build. Can we have 60 feet? Mm-hmm. And if they say no, then I think you need to get a lawyer.
Yeah. Yep. There you go, George. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Jim in Evansville, we'll go to you. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got about $15,000 in credit card debt, very little assets, and I'm just wondering if I pass, does that credit card debt go away?
Tom?
I can jump in here, Jim. First of all, if you've got less than $50,000 in net value at the time of your passing, there's no obligation for your family to open up what's called a probate case. When a probate matter is opened up, the notice is sent to creditors, and they have a right to file a claim to be repaid in the event that your estate has sufficient assets after its expenses from which they could be paid. And then there's a process to dispute that and a process to challenge the priority. If from the brief information that you shared, What I do want you to understand also is that whoever might inherit something from you or receive anything from you, if you're married or if you're unmarried and you have children, or if neither of those apply and you have siblings or parents still living, they're not obligated to pay those credit cards. And that's what most people end up asking is, can the credit card companies go after my family or my heirs or beneficiaries? And the answer to that is no, but kind of, if you have an estate that they can file a claim against. But in any event, what's really important for you to understand is if whoever would receive your property didn't sign the credit application form and the promise to pay on that contract with each creditor, with each credit card company, the credit card companies have no recourse against any of your family or friends or whoever you might want to leave some of your things to. So it doesn't sound very basically whether that's something that I think you should fret too much about, unless your net estate value is above $50,000, and there's some crafty and strategic ways that we can maximize your risk of having to lose some of your estate to those debts.
All right.
Yeah. The only other thing I'd say is, you know, you might want to do two things. One, there's plenty of people out there advertising they can help you with your credit card debt. I'm not shilling for them because I have no idea, but they might be worth at least talking to someone saying, what can you actually do for me? Most often, you know, they want you to give them a bunch of money up front, which I'd be very leery about. The other thing is you could certainly talk to a bankruptcy lawyer, because I think Tom's spot on in terms of what happens if you die. But hopefully you're not going to die for a while, and dealing with these blood-sucking leeches would be fair, probably. Look, the credit card companies give you money, but, you know, they encourage these minimum payments, which drag people further and further in. And really, you should at least look at the possibility of bankruptcy, I think. And so you get this out, and you can just start living your life and spending your own money, not having to make payments and seeing that amount grow and grow, which tends to happen.
Yeah. Jim, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Mike Riley and Tom Kolpin are attorneys with the Axley Law Firm. Tom's situated in Janesville, Wisconsin, with the firm's a branch there, and Mike, of course, in Madison, and he's an of-counsel attorney for Axley. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk legal issues with our two guests, Mike Riley and Tom Kolpin, at both practice law with the and members of the Axley Law Firm. It's great to have them with us today. And you can join in on open line, get you on pretty quickly. The number is 800-642-1234, and email to talk@WPR.org. We've got some emails. We'll get to those in just a minute, but I want to talk to Pat in DeForest first. Hi, Pat. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
I have a question about probate.
Okay.
My husband and I have a will, and we have three children, and all, you know, whatever's left of our estate when we pass would be divided equally among them. But I'm wondering, is that enough so that we don't have to go through probate if things are listed? Or, I mean, do they have to be listed particularly in detail, or are we good?
Yeah, and maybe, Tom, you could, what is probate, or why would we need to go through probate to begin with?
Sure. Probate is the court process by which a will is administered. Like I mentioned to the last caller that dealt with some credit card questions, the probate process involves the need to notify the state of Wisconsin if there's been any Medicare that's been provided, and the ability to recoup from assets, payment of some of those provisions. There's also a duty to notify and provide deadlines for creditors to file claims. So if you've got a will and your estate net value of your estate at the time of your passing is more than $50,000, then you will need to file a court action. Oftentimes it's called informal administration, a petition for informal administration. The main difference between informal administration and formal administration is that informal administration can happen largely outside of court with court-imposed deadlines and the filing of documents. Formal administration requires you, whoever is going to be named your executor or your personal representative, to have a court hearing and receive court approval for every single action you do. Formal administration often happens when the families have conflict and the beneficiaries don't believe that the will should be administered in a certain way, so they file objections to the will and demands for formal proceedings. But informal administration sounds like something, unless your net estate value is under $50,000, that could be handled through what's called summary assignment or summary settlement, depending on the nature of what you have to pass down. But yes, from the example that you're explaining, it looks highly likely that probate would be something that your family would be involved in upon the passing of both of you and your husband. Upon the passing of one of you, assuming that your will says what most standard wills say in a marital property state, the property from one of you passes to the other, and there would not be a need to have a probate process for that.
Right.
Tom, you know, one thing that I think might be interesting to people is what happens if you don't have a will, if we call it being intestate.
Sure.
What's the difference between having a will and dying intestate?
Sure. You may run into the same need to handle things through a probate court. Again, if your net estate value at the time of your passing is more than $50,000. The key difference between having a will and not having one is that in the absence of a will, Wisconsin law identifies what we call intestate succession, which is who has priority to receive things upon your passing. Generally speaking, if you're married, your spouse receives your property upon your passing without a will. If you're married but don't have a will, or if you're unmarried but you have children and you don't have a will, your property passes to your children. If you're married and it's a second marriage and you have children from the first marriage and you die without a will, half of your property goes to your spouse and the other half goes to your children. So there's some unintended consequences, especially with blended families and second marriages, sometimes even third marriages, fifth marriages, where you really want to have a will to designate how you want things to pass if it's going to be significantly different than the laws of intestate succession.
And I suppose if you didn't have a wife or you didn't have never had a spouse and you've never had children then, siblings, I suppose, would come into play then.
Sure. I've always explained it to folks I talk to that in the absence of a will, intestate succession starts with your spouse. And if you don't have spouses, it goes to your children. If you don't have a spouse or a child or children, it goes up the family tree and then back out. So it goes all the way up to your parents. And if you don't have parents, it goes out to the next branch if you have siblings.
Yeah.
And then if you have none of those, then there's a process by which the state could receive your estate.
Pat, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Ryan in Cable, Wisconsin, it's your turn.
So I bought a house for my parents, but they bought the house for $104,900 and then spent $60,000 renovating it. And then sold it to us for $74,000. Considering divorce at this point, how much would she be entitled to that house?
That's a very deeper question than simply what you've mentioned so far. You bought a house for $174,000. I think there's a lot of questions, which would be, when did you buy it? How long have you been married? What source of funds were used to purchase the house? How much in equity do you have in the house from the time you bought it to the time that you may be looking at a divorce? A variety of different factors come into play. The most notable of which is Wisconsin law is what we call a community property state, which means that in the absence of a prenuptial agreement or a postnuptial agreement, you might also hear that called a marital property reclassification agreement. In the absence of those, everything you bring to the marriage becomes marital property, and everything you have during your marriage, unless it's gifted or inherited, is also marital property. What you're telling me so far is, with very little facts to build from, that you bought a house during your marriage, and that house will be marital property. The presumption is it's going to be divided equally. There's a variety of different factors under Wisconsin law called deviation considerations or deviation factors. Deviation simply means the court can consider to not dividing that asset equally or considering it a marital asset to be divided equally based upon factors such as the length of the marriage, contributions to the marriage, and a variety of other factors that might have unique significance to your situation. And there's some broad discretion from the courts within those factors to look at fairness and equity, because that's the primary purpose. A divorce and family court, it's a court of equity, despite what most people believe.
Tom, the one thing I thought, maybe I didn't hear correctly, but I thought he was saying that he bought the house for his parents, then they put money into it, raising the value significantly, and then they sold it back to them for a bargain.
So oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
I thought that was...
I think you're right.
So the...
Maybe explain again.
Yeah.
Give us that quick set
sorry,
of facts
Pat,
again.
Or I'm sorry, Ryan.
We're kind of running a little short here.
I apologize.
So they bought the house initially, and they invested at least $80,000 into it, and then they sold it back to me for a greatly reduced rate as part of my inheritance.
Okay.
Okay. Well, that's a little bit different than what I thought I heard the first time, and it's definitely a little closer than what Mike may have heard. Key here is what I heard the first time is the parents bought a house for $104,900. They put approximately $60,000 in it, and then they sold it to you, Ryan. And I'm presuming, based upon what you've told me so far, is that this was sold to you, purchased by you during your marriage. Now, if they sold you a home at far less than fair market value and said, we are giving you this reduced price because you're now going to have a home cheaper than what we could sell it to anyone else for, so this equity that you receive is part of our quote-unquote inheritance to you, or what I'll call an advance on inheritance, then I would hope for your sake that they have some very clear documentation indicating that that was technically a gift directly to you only. But in the absence of a marital property agreement, classifying a certain part of that home as your separate and non-marital property, that's going to be a hairy situation for you.
Yeah. There you go, Ryan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dave emailed him. I don't know if we can do this in 30 seconds or so or 40 seconds, but Dave emailed to ask, revocable versus an irrevocable trust, what's an advantage? Is one more advantageous than the other?
Sure, I'll try to do that quick. Revocable and irrevocable are exactly how they sound. If you have a revocable trust, that means that if anything ever happens in your lifetime, that you decide, I don't want this anymore. Perhaps a family creates the Bill and Sue revocable family trust, and then Bill and Sue get divorced. They terminate that trust. It's revocable. You can close it out. You can reassign all the assets in a divorce case to who might receive them. That's one example. Family changes. That's an example. An irrevocable trust, once you create it, you can't revoke it. And many people do that to divest from themselves property they own in advance of applying for Medicare in the future, and they have a five-year look back to see if you've transferred any assets out of your own name. And they consider you not the owner of the property if it's an irrevocable trust.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Mike Riley and Tom Kolpian from the Axley Law Firm of Madison, Janesville, and elsewhere. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. We are talking with Mike Riley And Tom Colpine from the Axley Law Firm. Tom works out of Janesville. Mike is in Madison, located at their Madison office. Taking your questions, and you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Listener email that you mentioned property owners should make sure they have good insurance. How do you find a good company?
Well, first thing, I mean, we do have an insurance commissioner's office that takes complaints. They've got a list of the companies and the number of complaints they get. Not a sure thing, but it's certainly something that's worth looking at. I'm sure you can find that online. You know, we have a number of good companies in Wisconsin. I tend to lean in that direction. American Family here in Madison, Rural Mutuals here in Madison. There are a number of other companies. West Bend is a company in West Bend. And those are all Wisconsin companies. And I've dealt with all those companies over the years. And I'm generally on the other side, although I worked for insurance companies early in my career. But I represent people who are injured, and so I have to deal with them. And I think those companies are a cut above a lot of the other companies I deal with. So I think that's one thing to think about. I think there are some national companies. USAA is a company that represents, you have to have had some connection with the military.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's pretty attenuated now what that takes. And I've always found them to be a good company. Amica is another company that I've dealt with over the years. And there are a lot of others I don't mean to just single, but people ask the question. And I think that's at least a fair starting point.
Good answer there. John in Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance to join in. John, hello.
Hello. I had a little question about estate planning. We had a situation in my family where my aunts got remarried later on in life. They each had children from prior marriages. And once her husband passed away, her second husband, 100% of their assets went to my aunt and her children. His children didn't get anything. So my question is, how can I avoid that situation? I'm significantly older than my wife. We have significant assets. And, if I should pass away first and my wife gets remarried and then passed, how can I ensure that our assets go to our children, not to her future husband's children?
Yeah. Okay, Tom?
Yeah, sure. John, this is something that I think happens more frequently than people understand. This day and age with blended families, I happen to be someone who has a blended family. So I can certainly relate to this question. If you don't create advanced planning directives that strictly control how and when and under what circumstances your children from a prior marriage are to receive your property in the event that you pass away first, it won't happen, other than simply the trust of your partner ensuring that that person won't change their will in the future. So oftentimes you see a husband and wife of second marriages, they go get estate plans together and they say, if I pass away, all of my property goes to my spouse, and their reciprocal wills, we'll call them, they're mirrored. And then something happens where one of you pass away early, your spouse is widowed, maybe they even remarry. And you can see that trickle down effect, very similar to how your aunt's situation occurred. If you don't strictly allocate those assets in a way that is non-revocable, you always run the risk that something like that can happen. So you're going to want to meet with an estate planning attorney. Oftentimes, this can be done in a trust or even during your lifetime, transferring ownership of certain assets or payable on death for certain bank accounts, or what we call also termination on death, TOD or POD accounts, where you can say, I'm leaving these things to my children, maybe in the form of life insurance, or if you've got a retirement account that can just pass on death automatically, where it's not something that can be controlled by your current spouse and then in the future changed by your widow. There's some strategic ways that you can do that, and it really depends on your unique financial circumstances, what assets you have, and how you can reallocate them.
So he should be talking to an attorney who specializes
Yeah, I would definitely. Estate planning. Absolutely. I would recommend that.
You need to have that. He actually needs to have that if he wants.
If that's what his goal is and he wants to minimize that risk, I have never once jumped into the cockpit of a 747 and asked if I could fly the plane.
Yeah, all right. There you go. Thank you so much for calling, John. Mark in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mark.
I was doing some genealogical research at the Historical Society, and I found a probate from 1901 about would be a great aunt, but half. Her mother and my great-grandfather's mother were the same. So they somehow uncovered two relatives, one living in Budapest and one living in Aachen, Germany. And they sent letters to those U.S. consulates in those two places and went to those addresses and asked a bunch of questions whether those two folks would have any claim to these the estate of my great aunt. How did they do that?
Oh, boy, Mark, this is like a law school question.
And God, we feared those.
Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to start with something like this. I think you need to talk and sit down with a lawyer. There's probably layers to this. This looks like a big onion. I wouldn't even know where to start. I apologize.
And if Tom can't be helpful, I'm far removed from being helpful. So
there you go, Mark. You're going to have to dig into this with somebody who's going to sit down and really take a lot of time probably to figure out how they figured out where those people were.
Well, I guess I'm not even clear if Mark's asking, is he entitled to get something or is he just interested?
How do they look deeper into who else could be received things from the state? This sounds like an Indiana Jones type story.
Yeah. Man, oh, man. Jan in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Jan.
Hi there. I have something for Paul in Puma.
Okay.
I have some alternative suggestions for him.
Oh, good.
In Eau Claire, this is in several communities of size. In Eau Claire, we have something called the Eau Claire Community Foundation. And they help people set up the very thing that Paul is thinking of doing. Hmm. And they work a lot with your local community organizations that you probably would be interested in. The second thing is, besides the Community Foundation, is working through one of our Wisconsin colleges or universities to set up either a partial or a full scholarship. And the information you can get would be go right to the University Foundation for that information. Mm-hmm. So just two alternatives.
All right, Jan, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I set up a little scholarship fund myself for the UW-Madison, my home academic department. So, yeah.
That's great.
Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. We have some more emails here before we go back to the phones. And you can join in. There's lines open at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. David Madison emailed, he needs to write a simple will other than the considerable cost. What are the advantages of hiring an attorney versus using an internet service? He says a simple will, but I don't know what that means.
Sure. A simple will, I have to assume, is just basically going to name who you want to be your personal representative. If there's anything you have as far as personal belongings that you want someone individually to receive, your Brett Favre football collection or baseball cards or something like that. But, you know, generally speaking, I think if it's simple enough, you can draft it even on your own as long as you have it properly witnessed. These internet-based companies oftentimes will sell you state-specific forms. I'm aware of people that used to go back in the day to Office Max and pick up a form template for a will and fill them out that way. The only thing I would say is that if you don't know what Wisconsin law's requirements are for conformities of a will, you won't know whether that internet company has the right form, and you won't know whether, if you draft it yourself, will be proper. That being said, to the general public, if you don't have sophisticated situations, Wisconsin law is set up to try to take into account and make effective your intentions as much as possible in the absence of like extraordinarily procedural defects in your will. So there's presumptions that we want to follow your intent. And I guess that's the best I can tell you. Yeah. I just, for the peace of mind, I would encourage you to call and shop around because there's a lot of flat fees that can be handled for a simple will. And in the absence of high conflict that could be created after your passing where people are spending, it becomes extremely emotionally or financially expensive for your family to fight about something that wasn't drafted appropriately. The minimal cost of the upfront flat fee seems to be reasonable.
You know, if a lawyer drafts a will and screws it up, lawyers have insurance. They have malpractice coverage. You can do something about it. If one of these companies sells you one of these things and it doesn't work, I doubt you're going to have any recourse at all.
That's a great point.
Yeah. The University of Wisconsin Extension through Family Resources and Consumer Sciences, I believe, came up with several materials, rented, printed materials on wills, and I think even one was on doing your own will, and that was sort of Wisconsin-based. So that might be just for your own information. It'd be worth looking, going online to UW Extension, type in wills, and that Wisconsin-based information could at least be helpful to you as well.
Yeah, spent a lot of time talking about wills, and people have asked questions. And the truth is, you know, if you draft something and you draft it specifically, somebody asked about, well, I don't want these people to have anything. Well, you just say that. I mean, it's not enough to say who you want to have something. If you have somebody you don't want to have something, you know, rather than having them challenge it. And as Tom said, anybody can challenge anything. But it's really not going anywhere if you have said specifically. And the courts, as Tom said, are going to try to enforce your intent. But I think that's a great idea, Larry. Look at that. If you're going to try to do it yourself, make sure you have the appropriate information to do that.
Yeah. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you now.
Hi. I have a question, and then I also have a comment. The question is, my husband and I don't have children, and we have all of our liquid assets set up to be the survivor inherits, the survivor takes ownership, and then the ultimate, I guess it's payable on death, I'm not sure, but the ultimate, when the survivor dies, the assets pass directly to a charitable organization that we support. All of our liquid type assets, bank accounts and so on, are set up that way. We have three parcels of real estate, the house that we live in, which we hope to be carried out of in a box, and two parcels of recreational property that we are in the process of selling, but that is proceeding very slowly. So my question is, with the real estate, can we set it up the same way that the survivor of the two of us takes ownership upon the death of the first, and then when the survivor dies, can the real estate property, if it hasn't sold yet, can it pass directly to the charity and not have to go through probate?
Thanks, Stella. With respect to the real estate, you can certainly draft. Right now, your deeds to those pieces of real estate probably say joint tenants with the right of survivorship, or they're titled that way. And then you can create termination on death deeds, they're called, where you can name the agency or organization that you would want to receive or become the rightful owner of that land upon your passing. I'm always careful that I would want to see the document myself as an attorney to make sure that it's drafted the right way. So you shouldn't just presume that what I'm saying right now, you can just go quickly do without any legal review. But yes, the quick answer is there's a process for that. The other thing I would encourage you to do, to the extent that it doesn't create more family conflict for you, is make your intentions widely known, that's where you want your property to go. that you don't want it passing to a particular family. This is your choice. And then when you do those termination on death deeds, you're presumed competent, that you have the right to make the decisions yourself with your property during your lifetime. My advice to you is that if you go do that, have obviously you're going to have a witness or someone notarize your signature on the deed, but have some extra documentation or ask someone to at least create a memo that they met with you, that they talked to you about this. This is certainly your intention. Because oftentimes with family, when they feel like they've been written out of something, they want to argue and say someone's been negatively influenced and they were susceptible to that influence because of their age, infirmities, or anything like that. So your competence at the time that you signed these types of directives is something that you want to make sure you have some extra evidence of.
Yeah. I had knew someone who left his home, half of the home to his daughter, and the other half to his church. Mm-hmm. And he talked to both the daughter and got her to, you know, sort of buy, told her what he was going to do, got the buy-in, talked to the church. And it went off without a hitch when that happened.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point by both of you. So often we don't do that, and that's what we need to do. Communication is so critical, and it's so easy, but you have to do it. And as Tom says, it's also important to memorialize it in some cases just to make sure there's no question.
Yeah. Stella, thank you. Judy and Delavan, your turn.
Thank you. I'm administering my brother's estate. One of the heirs lives in California. He is dependent on SSI and whatever help California gives him, and he is refusing his inheritance for fear that he will wind up homeless, and because when he gets any money, they cut back on his support. My lawyer is trying to set up a needs trust, but my nephew tells me, leave me alone, I don't want anything to do with the lawyers. I don't know what to do now.
The first thing I would encourage you to do is make sure that you have all cards on the table with your lawyer. Make sure that your lawyer has all the same information that you have to properly advise you, and rely upon the advice of that lawyer. Your nephew has a right to say, I don't want anything. For any reason, whether it's something that we agree with or disagree with. And usually that term is called disclaimer, where you can say, I don't want it. And maybe the will or the estate planning documents provide for the next step down for what happens to that. But I'm highly confident that unless your lawyer started doing probate for the first time ever in your case, that there's going to be an exact protocol to do that. The needs trust that you mentioned, I don't know if it's a special needs trust. Those are quite intricate to create, but once you create them, they're protected forever for the benefit of the person with special needs. It doesn't sound like your nephew might have the basis for a special needs, but perhaps he does. But even in that event, no one's obligated to provide him things if he doesn't want them.
Yeah, the one thing, and I think Tom would say the same thing, you ought to get a written disclaimer from the nephew. Yeah. You need something from him. Your lawyer should certainly be able to draft something and just have him sign off on it and say, I don't want anything. Even a special needs trust, and I'm familiar with the term but don't know a lot about him, but it sounds like his concern is if he gets even constructive possession of this money, they're going to cut him off out there potentially, and he's probably much better off with what he's getting out there. But it's his decision to make, and he's made it. He just needs to document it.
And then Judy will have choices or things to make in terms of what to do with that money.
Well, I'd assume if, you know, barring something, unless it says specifically in the will, I'd assume that whoever else inherits, you just split that among them, wouldn't you, Tom?
You know, the other thing, my brain's going in a couple different circles now and thinking about the nephew. And I don't want to jump to the presumption that because he's receiving any kind of government assistance and he doesn't want to jeopardize that, that somehow he might have some other bigger issues going on. But when you brought up the portion of a needs trust, it makes me wonder whether or not the nephew should have appointed an attorney for him in Wisconsin called a guardian ad litem, which is an attorney that represents the best interests of people who may not be able to advocate properly for themselves. And the court would appoint that attorney, and it could potentially be an expense from the estate, or the county might even front that cost depending upon the nature of your estate. But someone should be looking out for your nephew's best interests, even if he can't. And that might be another wrinkle. I would advise you to talk to your attorney and see if that's an option.
So it does sound like Judy's trying to work in his best interest. But
yeah, absolutely.
For sure. Good luck, Judy. Thank you for calling. John and Marinette emailed, and this is probably our last question, that he and his wife held several stocks jointly. She died in December. Does his basis in any sum or all of the shares change? Oh, that may be something you guys may not be able to answer.
Yeah. Outside my field, certainly.
Yeah. Martha emailed, they moved to Wisconsin from another state within the past year. Their will and health care directive were established within the past 3 years in the state of Georgia. Will the will still be valid in Wisconsin, and what legally needs to be done for an address change? They no longer own property in Georgia, but now have property in Wisconsin.
Sure. I will never profess to know anything about Georgia law except for my father being a Georgia Bulldogs fan, and everything is Bulldogs in his life. But my best advice to you would be to recreate a new will in Wisconsin that conforms with Wisconsin law if your intention is to reside and be what we call domiciled in the state of Wisconsin by the time you pass. Maybe this isn't your landing spot, but it could be for unforeseeable reasons too. I believe that portions of your Georgia will, or maybe all of it, could be enforceable in Wisconsin. To the extent that Georgia has different kinds of laws that could affect succession of assets, I would hate for you to have your entire plan only be partially accepted. And that seems to be a silly approach to it in the event that you can create a new will and have a lawyer compare the two laws, look at what you want, and see whether or not it needs to be completely redrafted. Changing your address was sort of an ancillary question there. Changing your address can be with any governmental agency, third party company, and you do that no matter what. If you're living and you're domiciled in the state of Wisconsin at the time of your passing, whatever estate planning directives you have, that's what will be used, because you can't write a new one after you've passed away. So,
and on that note, Mike, Tom, thank you both very much for being with us. I hope we can
thank
do
you.
This again down the road. We didn't get to everything for sure, but hopefully we can do it another time.
Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
Michael Riley, a counsel attorney, and of counsel attorney at Axley Law Firm, Tom Copeland, is an attorney who practices family law, paternity, estate planning, and more. His partner, they're both in Axley Law Firm. Tom's in Janesville with the firm's office there, and Mike's in Madison. Coming up, we're going to talk about the Old Wade House. That next. I'm Larry Mailer. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mailer here. You know, Wisconsin has so many great historic sites, and today we wanted to focus on one of them, the Wade House in Sheboygan County. I've had a wonderful time visiting there, and I haven't done it in a few years and probably need to get back down there and take a look. And we'll find out what I've been missing these last few years and what you've been missing as well as we talk about the Wade House with Bridget Zielke. She's the site director at the Wade House, and maybe you visited it before like me. Tell us what you liked about it, or let us know why you recommend a trip. maybe you have a question about that particular area of our state. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Bridget Zielke, welcome. Thank you for joining in today.
Hi, Larry. Nice to be here.
So, why should you think about visiting the Wade House? Talk about what you think is so great about this historic place.
Absolutely. To begin, for those listeners who might not know what the Wade House is and where we're located, we are one of 12 historic sites of the Wisconsin Historical Society. We are located in Greenbush, Wisconsin, which is located halfway between Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and Fond du Lac. And once upon a time, the Wade House, which is a Stagecoach Inn, was located right on a plank road, a major artery that brought people and goods from the port of Sheboygan into Fond du Lac. This 1850s Stagecoach Inn has 27 rooms, and when you visit Wade House, you get a tour of the Wade House, and our guides are dressed in 1860s clothing so that you get a sense of what it would have been like to, if you're a female, to work in a long dress near a hot fire. But the site is really telling the story of two frontier entrepreneurs, Betsy and Sylvanus Wade, who were traveling west from Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. And on their way, they found Greenbush, and they thought it'd be a great place to settle and to develop a community. And there were a few reasons they thought it was a good location for a community. It had a river running through it, so there was a source of power for a sawmill. It also was on this major thoroughfare, again, between the port city of Sheboygan and Fond du Lac. And I think they just liked the beauty of the state of Wisconsin as well. In addition to having the Wade House at the Wade House Historic Site, we have a blacksmith shop, we have a sawmill, and we have Wisconsin's, I think it may be the only carriage museum in the state. And we have more than 80 hand-drawn and horse-drawn vehicles that were all collected and restored by Wesley W. Young, a Sheboygan native.
It's a really, really cool place. And Sylvanus Wade, I mean, he must have had some money for his time back then. He bought a bunch of property and wound up building that house, which is fantastic.
Yes, and he was a true entrepreneur. So as they were traveling west, again, they settled upon Greenbush, but he did buy, he and his son-in-law, Charles Robinson, purchased 400 acres, and they, in Greenbush, and or what would become Greenbush, and then they parceled that land out and started selling it with the dream of, again, developing a city. And really, their dream came true. Within, I'd say, 4 to 6 years, Greenbush was a bustling community. It had a wagon shop. It had a blacksmith shop. It had a church. It had many homes and farms. And again, its heyday happened because of this plank road that was traveling with people and goods, again, between the port city of Sheboygan and Fond du Lac.
Yeah. And it was a place where people could actually, they rented rooms for travelers.
Right. So when they arrived in Greenbush, it was 1844. So before the state of Wisconsin had become a state, and they found, and they at that point lived in a log cabin that they had constructed. And there was so much traffic along that road, they found that people were looking for overnight accommodations and meals. So they started earning income by offering, you know, a bed in one of their rooms of this small log cabin. And Betsy was known for her hospitality and her great food. So that then led them to the idea of, hey, let's build this Greek Revival style structure, the Wade House, which they did build in the late 1840s with their son-in-law, Charles Robinson. And they opened the Stagecoach Inn in 1850 and immediately were filling their rooms. So you're correct about what they offered to the travelers. They offered meals, and Betsy Wade would be cooking meals three per day. And, it was quite the to-do to be able to sit down at her dining room table and enjoy her skills and what she put on the table for you. But they also had two different types of accommodations in the Wade House. So they could have people who stayed long-term, and the long-term residents would be on the second floor of the Stagecoach Inn. And there were suites on the second floor, which included a sitting room and a bedroom. Those could be rented for $2 a night and included board. So they would be served three meals a day and have this lovely space to stay. Now, if you traveled up another flight of stairs, you would reach the third floor where I most likely would have been staying. And that was for short-term accommodation. And there were eight single private rooms, and those were mostly reserved for females traveling alone or families or men with a little who are more affluent. But then on that third floor, there's this big, large public space where for a few pennies, you could, if you had your bedroll, unroll your bedding and sleep there for the night.
Pretty cool. Somebody's already wondering, what is a plank road?
That's a very good question. So the plank road was a road that was made out of planks or logs, and it replaced the uneven dirt paths that used to be the trails that went from Sheboygan to Fond du Lac. So it was a newer type of road, and the plank road that ran through Greenbush was completed in 1852, and it made a ride in a stagecoach much more comfortable. It wasn't as bumpy as a ride on a dirt road.
And that was a typical method of travel. Get on the stagecoach and travel from one spot to another, wasn't it, back then?
It was. And there are some really interesting maps of the state of Wisconsin that show the many stagecoach trails, stagecoach roads that traveled through the state of Wisconsin. So one main artery, again, was from Sheboygan to Fond du Lac. And there was a stage line, the John Frink stage line, and they offered, I have an advertisement of theirs that I found in the Sheboygan Mercury, a newspaper from that time period, that touted that they had daily lines that left from Sheboygan at 6 a.m. and would get you, actually 7 a.m., and would get you to Fond du Lac by 6 p.m. So it was an 11-hour trip from Sheboygan to Fond du Lac, and that was a fast trip. Now we can travel that distance in 40 minutes. So,
yeah, 40 minutes.
That was the mode of travel.
Well, and how dangerous? I mean, I think about the movies that I've seen, the Old West movies, where the stagecoach is being attacked by bank robbers and that sort of thing. Was how dangerous was it to travel across the state?
That's an excellent question. And I think you're hitting on something. It was, at that time, I'm sure they felt it was safe, but in today's standards, I don't believe it was probably the most safest route of transportation, because those stagecoaches are being pulled by four horses. And obviously those four horses are being driven by a stagecoach driver or a whip, someone who is very talented in managing the reins of four horses. But we're speaking of traveling over roads that might not be plank roads. They might be dirt roads. You're going to run over roots. You're going to run, and if it's a muddy, rainy day, you're going to get stuck in mud. So there were accidents, and this is interesting. Abbott Downing is a wagon and carriage maker out of Concord, New Hampshire, and they made between 1,700 and 2,500 stagecoaches, and their stagecoaches were renowned. They were like a Cadillac of stagecoaches. And of those, there are only 160 remaining.
Oh.
And I'm sharing that because what you find with some of the stagecoaches that still exist is they have the body of one stagecoach and the running gear of another, because those stagecoaches would tip over and the body of the stagecoach would be damaged beyond repair. So, you know, they'd use parts of another stagecoach that was also damaged to put together a used one to continue traveling. So.
Oh, man. So, you know what? Before we get any further, I want to remind everybody we're talking today with Bridget Zielke, is the site director at the Wade House. It's a Wisconsin historic site. If you haven't seen it, you got to see it. And if you haven't been for a while, you're going to be surprised. I think there's been some changes and so forth, updating, certainly in the last 10 years, that you're going to your job will probably drop when you take a look at it. Questions for them, or even an experience. If you visited the Wade House, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, WPR relies on community support and your contribution. It helps ensure accurate, fair, and independent reporting and programming. And our winter member drive is quickly approaching. It's this Thursday, as a matter of fact. We have a special challenge to help meet our goal. And you could become one of 600 people who donate before Thursday, and a generous group of members will give an additional $10,000 for WPR programs. You can do it right now. Join in right now while you're listening here at WPR.org/donate. That's WPR.org/donate. As we talk with Bridget Zielke, the site director at the Wade House, a Wisconsin historic site. Again, join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Have you visited? Question about it? Love to hear from you as we move along through the show. Are there some special features? I know there are some special features of the Wade House that were maybe ahead of their time, but can you talk about some of those?
Oh, that's a great question. The Stagecoach Inn, again, was opened in 1850, and I find the architectural style, I love Greek Revival style architecture, but I find it interesting that the Stagecoach hotels that were located along these roads, many of them were designed in the Greek Revival style of architecture because it allowed travelers to be able to easily identify, oh, this is a place where I can stay overnight. This is a place where I can go in and get something to drink in the tap room, or this is a place where I can have a meal. So I think it's interesting that they're using this style of architecture as a way for travelers across the U.S. really to identify a hotel, a place to stop. In the Wade House, I also find this interesting. It was completed in 1850 and opened in 1850. And the very next year, they added on a summer kitchen. So they found that they had so much traffic and Betsy Wade was serving so many travelers these meals that they needed more workspace, and they also needed a cooler kitchen. So this summer kitchen that they added on has two exterior doors. So you can open the doors and there's cross ventilation. And they, in that summer kitchen, they also have a well. So it's very unusual that they encapsulated in the house a water well. So they didn't have to go outside to the well. It was conveniently located right in the summer kitchen, pretty near the cook stove where they would have heated the water that they used for cooking or for cleaning.
I'm trying to remember, did they use ice blocks from the river?
Well, there is a mill pond here, and yes, they would have used, ice blocks from the mill pond.
To use as refrigeration or cooling or whatever, I would imagine.
Yes.
So maybe we can talk about the sort of, at one point, it moved from the Wade family. I mean, people died and...
It did. And thank you for asking that question. So the Wade family, again, built it and they operated it and they lived in it all the way until 1941. So 1850 to 1941. And in 1941, the Wade family sold it to a family friend. Her name was Mary Dorst. And she was hoping to make it into a tea house. But by that time, it was pretty... It needed a lot of attention, and she found that she just didn't have the means to restore it. So thankfully, in our neck of the woods in Sheboygan County, we have a very generous, gracious family, the Kohler family. And Ruth DeYoung Kohler, who was Herbert V. Kohler Jr.'s mother, and his aunt, Marie Christine Kohler, saw that this Stagecoach Inn was derelict and needed attention, and they both were history buffs and studied social history and decided to take the project on. So they meticulously, the two women, under the umbrella of the Kohler Foundation, restored the Wade House, and that was in the, they bought it in 1950, and so from 1950 to 1953, they did the restoration. They also restored another building on our property, which is known by two names, the Butternut House, and it's also known as the Robinson House. It's where Charles Robinson, the son-in-law of Sylvanus Wade, and Wade's daughter, Julia, lived. And it was made out of butternut. So that is why it was known as the Butternut House. But the Kohler Foundation restored that too. So the property opened in 1953. And if you would have come in 1953, you would have received a tour of the Wade House, a tour of the Robinson House, and then also the blacksmith shop was on site at that point.
Yeah.
But again, we are very grateful for, I will say, the continued support of the Kohler family. And so with the site opening and the Kohler Company and the Kohler Foundation and the Kohler Trust for Preservation. But with the site opening in 1953, it's really expanded, Larry. So, you know, if you would have come in 1953, you would have arrived at the corner of Plank Road and Center Street, and you would have visited those three structures. And today we've added a sawmill, and that was added in 2001. And it's a water-powered sawmill, and our guests get to see a sawyer at work in this sawmill. And it's the coolest thing to hear and see an up and down muley saw from the 1850s, the time of when that sawmill actually operated, slicing through a log. So I highly recommend it. It's, I will tell you, it's my husband's favorite part of the visit to the Wade House. I think it's the rumbling of the saw going up and down and the smells. It's a very, that the visit to the sawmill really attracts you by your senses. All of them are touched.
Oh, smell, but also, for sure.
Yes, and we've also added a visitor center. So the new visitor center opened in 2013, and it's located right on Highway 23. And there were a couple reasons why the visitor center opened. To begin, our visitation dropped because people were no longer driving by Wade House. The route of Highway 23 changed. And so no longer did you drive by the Wade House and be curious. So we decided, hey, we need to have a structure on Highway 23 so we have that visibility again of those travelers coming through. And then we needed a new home for our carriage museum. We have a wonderful carriage museum, the Wesley W. Young Carriage Museum, that opened on the site in 1968. But those vehicles were all displayed in a building that didn't have air conditioning, and it didn't have heat. So that's not the best place, obviously, to store artifacts. And this new visitor center has a 20,000 square foot carriage museum with the appropriate HVAC to keep the vehicles preserved for a long, long time.
And you mentioned earlier, we were talking about the stagecoaches. And do you have a stagecoach there?
We do.
Yeah, that is worth seeing.
So we have three stagecoaches. Two are reproduction stagecoaches made by Hanson Wheel and Wagon out of South Dakota. And we just acquired a new original 1875 stagecoach made by Abbott Downing out of Concord, New Hampshire. And it was a gift to the Wade House. It arrived the day before Thanksgiving in 2024. And it is a beautiful vehicle to see. We are having an unveiling of that stagecoach number 433 on May 3rd. And I highly recommend your listeners, if they want to come visit, that's a good day to visit, because not only can they see this original stagecoach, they can also, we're going to have one of our reproduction stagecoaches out on the property giving rides to guests. They're 30-minute rides, and, you know, when do you get the opportunity to climb into a stagecoach? We even have a portion of our road surface is a plank road, so you feel the difference between traveling on a dirt road and a plank road. It will be a great opportunity. And we have these stagecoach rides throughout the summer. So if they can't come on May 3rd, they can take a look at our website and come another time.
I've got to get up there for that. I want to get inside that stagecoach and go for a ride. And you know, we should mention that even during the winter, you have some fun outdoor activities going on.
We do. So our visitor center is open in the winter months, and our winter months are the second weekend in November through the middle of May. So with the visitor center, you can come and see the Carriage Museum, but our special events include hearthside dinners. So hearthside dinners are an experience where you do some work in the kitchen, like Betsy Wade would have done at the Wade House. You come in and there's a group of 14 people. Those 14 people are divided into teams. Each team is given a recipe. You're given the produce you need and the ingredients you need, and you're given some historic reproduction kitchen tools. And you go to work at assembling that recipe. Once it's ready and it gets put on the open hearth or the cook stove, you tour the Wade House. But you get to enjoy the fruits of your labor after the tour. All 14 guests sit down at Betsy Wade's dining room and the dining room of the Stagecoach Inn. And, you know, all of our guests just rave about the experience because it really, I think, takes you back in time, right? You're in the spaces where she was making these meals for travelers, and then you're sitting at the dining room table, and it's a communal event because it's family style. So just as if you were a traveler squeezed into a stagecoach or squeezed at that, you know, that dining room table, you're getting to know each other.
Yeah, I have not done that yet. That's something I've got on my bucket list of things to do, because it sounds like just so much fun. And
it is.
It's got to be. And there is it, you know, when you've got snow there, you can sled, and there's some opportunities for skiing or sledding, I think, as well.
You're right. We have snowshoes that are available if you come and visit the Visitor Center and Wesley W. Young Carriage Museum. Free of charge, you can use snowshoes. We just need some snow for that activity. And we also, there's always one Saturday in the winter where we offer sleigh rides. And we did have snow for the Saturday that we offered them this year. And it was so lovely. It's a different type of transportation, right?
Yeah.
Being pulled by horses in a sleigh. And I must say, any visit to the Wade House during our main summer season does include a horse-drawn wagon ride. So you start at our visitor center and you're taken for a mile-long trip down to the historic core where you see the Wade House, the sawmill, and the blacksmith shop.
Bridget, I want to thank you so much. And I hope people go online to the Wade House, the website. There's beautiful photos and a lot to see. And it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. I hope to see you up there.
I hope so too, Larry.
Sometime this summer. I want to get on that stagecoach. Bridget Zielke, the site director at the Wade House, obviously knows a whole lot about it. It's a Wisconsin historic site. Great to have her with us, and great to have you listening in. Thank you so much. to our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Padnott, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.